America's buy-in. And we need many more people's help in answering the questions that I have mentioned and that you will be raising today. And that's why I have put so much emphasis on outreach to those I call non-traditional stakeholders who have traditionally lacked a voice at the FCC. And that's why I've been pushing so hard for hearings. And I am genuinely grateful for the chairman's decision to hold an official commission public hearing in Richmond next month. That's a good and an absolutely necessary first step. But I'm still pushing for the commission to get even further outside the Beltway and to find out firsthand what has been happening in markets of various sizes and configurations over the past 10 or 15 or 20 years and what might happen in the future if we take some of the steps being considered. So I intend still to do such hearings around the country. It looks like New York made the wise decision that it would not wait for an FCC hearing. It decided to make its voice heard. So I am enormously pleased to be here today. But it should not fall exclusively to private organizations to rally the public on these matters. That's just not right. I believe it's our responsibility and our public interest duty to reach out and tell people and inform people what's happening and then to solicit their input and listen to their input. The day before yesterday, all five FCC commissioners testified before the Commerce Committee of the United States Senate. My friends, I was enormously encouraged by what I heard there. While we still have a lot of work to do, anyone who thought the commission would be able to change these rules because Congress didn't care has probably had to think again, given the outpouring of concern about the dangers of consolidation that I heard from senators on both sides of the aisle at that hearing. And I'm 100% convinced that congressional concern will grow because of events like the one today. So there's already some positive effect from your efforts, but we still have a long, long ways to go. And when you leave here, go back to your homes and talk and write about this issue. Get your local media involved. Insist that these issues be covered. Help make this the national dialogue that the issues merit and the national debate that every American needs to hear. There's no more important work for you to be doing. Good luck in your deliberations today. I'm looking forward to being here for them, and thank you very much for your attention.
That is Federal Communications Commissioner Michael Copps, C-O-P-P-S, on this Pacifica Radio live broadcast from Columbia University Law School on media ownership. We'll be bringing this to you for the next 5, 6, or 7 hours. Panels, beginning with Federal Communications Commissioners, four of them. The next one who will address us is one of the Republican commissioners, one of the Republican majority. This would be Commissioner Kevin Martin.
I understand that many of you here today are concerned about the consolidation that has occurred in the media today, as well as what could occur even in the future. I share your concerns. Every one of us is dependent on the media. It's how we get our news, information, and entertainment. Indeed, the opportunity to express diverse viewpoints lies at the heart of our democratic system. The decisions the FCC makes with respect to media ownership will be important to sustaining that participation and opportunity to participate in our democracy as well, and affect each of us on a daily and individual personal basis. Our media ownership rules may even have an impact on some of the FCC's other responsibilities and obligations. For example, there seems to be an increasing concern with the rise of coarse television programming today. I wonder if this trend is related to some of the concerns about media consolidation. Are executives more willing to put on questionable programming when they know they won't see you and your family at the local grocery store tonight, at the game on Saturday, or at church on Sunday? And I believe Commissioner Copps deserves credit for asking these questions and for keeping us mindful of these concerns. The existing media ownership rules were crafted to promote three principles: competition, diversity, and localism. While the media marketplace may have changed since those rules were first adopted, our need to promote these values has not. I remain committed to doing everything I can to ensure that the FCC adopts ownership rules that protect competition, diversity, and localism in today's media environment. I recognize, however, that Congress instructed us to review our media ownership rules every 2 years and to make sure that they are still necessary. It is our fulfillment of that mandate that brings us together today. As we debate these rules, we must do so mindful of recent court actions. As you know, the courts have been looking at our rules with increasing scrutiny, striking these rules down when the Commission has not adequately justified their attention. In fact, the D.C. Circuit has struck the last five media ownership rules it has reviewed. In most of these cases, the court has expressly chastised the Commission for failing to consider the plethora of new voices out there today. With these recent court cases in mind, the chairman should be commended, not condemned, for initiating our proceedings and attempting to justify our rules. Without his actions, his leadership, and our deliberate process, we could have been left with no rules whatsoever. Because the courts have insisted that we recognize that the media landscape has changed dramatically since most of the broadcast ownership rules were first enacted. The number of broadcast networks has doubled, and we now have non-broadcast networks, 230 national cable programming networks, and more than 50 premium networks that regularly rival the broadcast networks in its audience share. Their success naturally is due to the introduction and widespread popularity of our multi-channel video programming distributors. Today, over 85% of households receive their video programming via satellite or cable. And finally, the advent of the Internet has dramatically changed how people send and receive information. It now represents a significant outlet for diverse views, as well as important sources of news and information. One rule in particular has not been reviewed since many of these changes have taken place: the prohibition against a newspaper and a broadcast station being owned by the same owner in the same market. Today, newspapers alone are treated differently from all other forms of business that disperse information. They alone are prohibited from joint ownership, even in the largest markets. Even broadcast television stations are generally permitted to combine in large markets. The Commission first stated 7 years ago, and several times since, that this rule might need modifying. But after three notices, it has not yet acted. At a minimum, I think we need to act to provide broadcast stations and newspapers the same opportunities to combine that television stations have in the largest markets. But on the other hand, the introduction of these new voices in the marketplace does not mean that all of our limits will be relaxed or need to be, or that consolidation should not be a concern. Indeed, I believe that the SEC needs to be mindful of the unintended consequences, as Chairman Powell explained, for many of our changes in our rules. For example, many people have expressed concern about the increased consolidation that has occurred in local radio. Some of this consolidation, though, may actually be due to the Commission's definition of a market rather than the changes in the numerical limits that were actually enacted by Congress. For example, there are towns in Texas in which one company can own 7 of the 8 radio stations in the town. But to be able to own 7 stations, Congress said there should be at least 30 other stations. Yet the owner purchased those 7 stations in compliance with our rules, because our rules often, and too often, treat small towns like big markets. The problem lies in the FCC's definition of a market and in the obscure counting method for determining how many stations are actually present and one entity can own. So we need to correct those problems as well. And we have asked about fixing those problems in the same ownership proceeding that we are talking about. So clearly there's no easy answers today, and the task we confront is significant. And we are fully aware of how central these decisions will be to making our lives, as many of you well know. Thus, I welcome your insights, and I will look forward to hearing from you both today, this morning, and in the months to come. Thank you very much.
That is FCC Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner Martin.
Kevin Martin.
Commissioner Adelstein, please.
Kevin Martin, one of the Bush administration Republican appointees to the Federal Communications Commission, is former general counsel for the 2000 Bush campaign. At 38 years old, he's the youngest of the FCC commissioners. This is Jonathan Adelstein, who has joined the Federal Communications Commission very recently, within the past few weeks, one of the two Democrats on the five-member commission. Jonathan Adelstein, live from New York City, Columbia University Law School.
I want you to think for a moment, what would you do in my position? You come into a new job like this, you just began, and imagine that the future of the media landscape and the future of our very democracy was something that you had 1 of 5 votes on. I think you'd probably stay here all day. And that's what I plan to do, because I need to learn. I need to learn from you and I need to learn from the panelists what we need to do about this. You know, we're five very smart people, at least four of us, the other four. And I think that we have too much responsibility, to be honest with you. We've been charged by Congress with determining what the public interest standard is under these media ownership rules. That's about as much guidance as we have from Congress. At one point, I asked one of our top staffers at the FCC, what's the legislation on this? What's the basis in law? And he kind of looked at me funny, like, what do you mean? Because most of the legal superstructure of this is built upon years of regulatory and administrative law and not on the statutory construction, because if you read the statute, it talks about the public interest, but it doesn't define what it is. And so they deferred to the commission the determination of what is in the public interest in terms of how we structure the media. And that's a big question for us to answer, because, you know, the courts are demanding objective evidence. The courts are demanding that we explain somehow exactly what the public interest means in terms that can be quantified with evidence. Now, how many voices are enough in a city of 250,000, would you say, if you had to answer this question? Is it five? Is it six? Is it seven? You want to give me an objective answer? Now, what if it's a city of 50,000? You need four voices. You need three voices. How are we supposed to determine this with some kind of objective evidence? It's an incredibly difficult challenge, and that's why I say we have too much responsibility. I think Commissioner Copps raised some very great questions that we need to answer, but I'm not sure how we get answers to these kind of questions in the time frame that we have. And it's not our chairman's fault, it's not my colleague's fault that we have the time frame we have. The courts are pressing us. In my opinion, the courts are pressing us too hard. But that's a higher authority than we are in our system of government, and we have to respond to the courts. And that's why we're here today. You know, I think that this forum is another step in our record-building efforts. And I see today's panelists as a cross-section of some of the many stakeholders in this proceeding. They're journalists, content producers, and a cross-section of educators, and even more importantly, your listeners, viewers, and participants in our democracy. You have a stake in this proceeding. We want to hear from you. Now, looking back to the Supreme Court interpretation of this, the FCC is charged with protecting what the Supreme Court referred to as the, quote, uninhibited marketplace of ideas, end quote. What does that mean in the context of the ownership debate? I'd like to read a bit from that seminal First Amendment decision to kick off our discussion today. This is the Red Lion case. Quote, it is the right of the public to receive suitable access to social, political, aesthetic, moral, and other ideas and experiences, which is crucial here. The right may not be constitutionally abridged by either Congress or by the FCC. So the Supreme Court of the United States has itself stated that the FCC may not get in the way of Americans' unfettered access to ideas. We must not allow the structure of the industries that distribute ideas and creative products to limit the voices that can be heard in this country and in each of our communities. So how should we structure our ownership rules? How do we balance the public interest values that we're charged with determining? Your participation is a crucial part of our decision-making process. And that process depends on it, but more importantly, the outcome depends on it. There's just no way the Commission can fully understand the impact of our decisions and what they'll have on different constituencies unless we hear from those constituencies. If we're to craft media ownership rules that best serve the public interest, we've got to hear from the public. And that's why we're here. That's why we're glad you're here. So thank you for being here, and I look forward to hearing from all of you and from our distinguished panelists.
FCC Commissioner Jonathan Edelstein, who has been on the commission only since December 3rd as one of the two Democratic minority commissioners.
Commissioner Edelstein, Commissioner Martin, Commissioner Copps, Chairman Powell. Before we begin the panel, we are privileged that Congressman Gerald Nadler of New York is also here, and I will ask him to say a few remarks on this occasion.
Congressman Nadler is a longtime Democratic representative from the west side of Manhattan.
Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to be here today. The decisions the FCC will make soon regarding media ownership rules are going to have, as I think everyone who's here knows, a profound effect on our society. Do we want to live in a country where the control of the media is concentrated in very few hands? Or do we want to hear from a diverse group of people with different viewpoints and perspectives? What does that mean not only to our entertainment options and our news sources, but to our very democratic form of government. Those are what is at stake in the rulings the FCC will make and also in the statutes that Congress passes. I, for one, abhor the concentration of power. There are only 16 of us who voted against the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which I did for two reasons. One, the Communications Decency Act, later thrown out by the Supreme Court. But secondly, because I feared that the Telecommunications Act would open the door to a mass concentration of power in the hands of very few people in the media. I'm sorry to say that my fears have come true already to too great a degree. Since the rules were abolished on radio ownership in 1996, just the two biggest companies have increased from controlling 130 stations to controlling more than 1,400 stations, with the attendant effects on localism, on diversity of viewpoints. I must say also that this question of concentration of power and diversity in media received relatively little attention and debate in Congress, maybe in the committee, but very little in Congress. The big debate that we were all lobbied about with respect to the Telecommunications Act was the relative power and with respect to the baby bells versus so-called baby bells, versus the long distance companies. Whether to allow the baby bells to get into long-distance communications and what access to give other people to break the baby bells local monopolies. That was the great controversy. The effect on media ownership and diversity was paid very, very little attention to. And yet concentrating control of information sources in very few hands endangers open debate and endangers democratic self-government. I was intrigued by what Chairman Powell said, that the courts have ruled, in effect, that the burden of proof for maintaining any limits or any rule lies on showing empirical evidence, lies on the FCC, and maybe we in Congress should revisit that and should allow the retention or the strengthening of rules just in the interests of diversity of opinion and diversity of ownership. That itself, it seems to me, should justify these rules without the necessity of showing other factors or commercial factors. The uninhibited marketplace of ideas cannot be maintained if five people decide what we should see, what news we should see, what commentators we should hear, what opinions we should hear. So I'm very grateful to the Center for holding this hearing to enable more people to express their opinions. And I hope both the FCC and Congress will show some wisdom in enabling us to retain this democratic government of ours for another 200 years. Thank you.
New York Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler, whose district includes Columbia University, where this forum is taking place today in New York City, a forum on concentration of media ownership, being brought to you live on Pacifica Radio.
Formal portion of today's forum. I am delighted to introduce our moderator, Harry Jessel, whose long experience as a reporter for broadcasting and cable magazines includes extensive coverage of the FCC. Since 2000, he has been editor-in-chief of that magazine. We are most fortunate that he has agreed to lend his expertise to today's proceedings. Harry Jessel will introduce the first panel, and we will carry on from there.
And you're listening to WBAI. Those of you tuning in for First Voices, that program and all programming has been suspended for this special day of broadcasting. First Voices will be back next Thursday in their usual time, and also we'll be broadcasting in a special mode this coming Saturday afternoon. After the rally in Washington, they will be broadcasting from 4 to 5 p.m. on Saturday.
Became president. He wasted no time in bringing his marketplace ideology to the FCC. He sent to the FCC an affable fellow named Mark Fowler, a like-minded communications attorney who was determined. Actually, he called, he came in there after calling the TV set, the TV set was nothing but a toaster with pictures. That was, And he was determined to get the government out of the TV and radio business. Fowler began loosening the content and ownership rules and began a process that has really continued to today. When Fowler arrived at the FCC, a single company was allowed to own only seven TV stations, seven AMs, and seven FMs. That was it, 777, coast to coast. In terms of station ownership, ABC, CBS, NBC were no bigger than Westinghouse and some other big broadcast groups, right, Gil? And with some exceptions, the most that a company could own in a single market was either one TV station or two radio stations, the AM-FM combo. Well, Fowler did get to work, and in 1984, as I understand the history, he got a vote to wipe out all the national ownership rules. Unfortunately for him, there was a backlash in Congress, and then on reconsideration, he came back and simply raised the 777 to 12-12-12, 12 a.m., 12 f.m., 12 TV, and he put a kicker in there on the TV, a backstop, that said, well, you can own 12 stations, but as long as the 12 stations don't serve more or reach more than 25% of all TV households. So that's where we stood, and then we had another Republican president, the first President Bush, and he appointed a fellow named Alfred Sykes, and Sykes went after the ownership rules, too. He took them up to the radio side, up to 2020. Now you could do 40 stations nationally, 20 AMs, 20 FMs. He wanted to go after TV, but he for political reasons mostly. I think he had a Democratic Congress at the time. He stuck with the 12 station cap and the 25% reach cap on TV. Well, President Reagan came along. The Republicans took control of Congress, and then 1996, Congress weighed in with the Telecommunications Act. And as Representative Nadler said, the ownership provisions in here were sort of an incidental. I mean, this was supposed to bring competition between radio or between cable and the telephone industries, and the broadcasters sort of glommed on some ownership dereg for themselves. And what that law did was totally remove the national radio ownership cap, and allowed ownership up to eight stations in a market. I think it in Sykes' time, he had it up to four. It was raised up to eight by that law. There's a lot of lawyers in the room, so you can correct me if I'm wrong here. And in television, it eliminated that numerical 12-station cap. And so from there on, we were just going to rely on this reach cap that was 25%, and the 96 Act raised it to 35%. That act really is, again, as the representative said, that touched off a big wave of consolidation in radio and produced a clear channel behemoth, 1,300 stations by itself. Also cleared a way for a lot of TV mergers. I guess that's where we got, is that where Westinghouse and CBS came together after that? A lot of acquisitions, the big groups gobbling up the smaller groups. Viacom and Fox actually have hit that 35% cap, and pending some changes in the rules, they may have to do some divesting too. So, Bill Kennard, he came in after Reed Hunt during the Clinton administration, and in 1999, he relaxed the so-called duopoly rule to allow ownership of two stations in large markets. And large markets were defined as those markets where there were eight independent voices or eight different owners. So, in a way, he was sort of codifying what had already happened in the marketplace, because for the previous several years, the FCC was sort of signing off on what were known as local marketing agreements, where one owner in a market would manage another station in the market. And so what Kennard really did was sort of just codify what had already taken place in the marketplace. But because you could now own two stations, two TV stations in a market, big groups could get together, not because they were going to, as long as they stayed under the 35% cap, they could get together with that fear that their local stations would overlap in markets. So as you look at this thing, be particularly aware of these local ownership rules, because by relaxing the local ownership rules, you allow things to happen, the big groups and merge on a national basis. What I've discussed, you've heard a lot of facts, and one of the, as a result of all that deregulation over the year, the top 25 TV groups now own more than 40% of the commercial TV stations. That may not sound like a lot to some of you, but it is. It's a big change over 20 years when there were hundreds more owners and thousands more radio owners, perhaps. And those top 25 station groups tend to own those stations in the biggest markets where the bulk of the population is. I've been talking about station ownership deregulation, but really the biggest change, I think, over the last 10 years was the elimination of the or the repeal of the financial interest and syndication rule. This is a rule that barred the networks from owning their primetime programming. When that thing went down in 93 after probably the most intense lobbying battle I ever saw at the FCC, I think it makes this thing look like kids play so far. I mean, it could get more serious. A lot of the people in this room were involved in that battle. But after several years of intense fighting, and the courts weighed in on that too, the FCC finally did repeal these rules, and for the first time, in about 20 years, the networks and the a single company could own both a network and a studio. A company like Disney could buy ABC, which is exactly what it did. So that really produced those big five companies that Commissioner Copps talked about. Rich Pilotti, a security analyst here in town, said that those five companies, Viacom, Disney, NBC, AOL, Time Warner, and Fox, actually control 85% of primetime programming. I would add to that if you think about what they do in syndication, soap operas, late night talk shows, and their local station newscasts, they also dominate the other day parts too. So all of television is really, that was a great chart, because all of television is really controlled by those five companies, at least on a national basis. The only other television, other national sources of television are USA Networks, Vivendi, Discovery Communications, and Scripps, PBS, of course. I think those were on your chart too. So now that sounds like a terrible thing. We're down to five companies controlling all that television. But, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, it was just three. So I don't know if this is good news or bad news to have five. I'll let the commissioners decide. And that particular issue is not as part of this review, as I understand it, but a coalition of producers and I think some advertisers are in there did come in and are now asking the FCC to maybe put back some of that financial interest and syndication rules, sort of set aside 25%. They want the broadcast networks to set aside 25% of their primetime schedule for independent producers that have no financial ties to the networks. So we've had two decades of media consolidation prompted by the FCC and Congress with occasional assists from the courts. But we are not done yet. I think, as the chairman pointed out, a lot of the impetus for this is coming from outside the FCC. Although, if you watched C-SPAN the other day and watched all the senators squawking about the media consolidation, you might be surprised that, as the chairman said, it was Congress that mandated that the FCC do this every 2 years. So the commission has that congressional mandate, and as the chairman pointed out, they also have a series of court decisions that give the FCC very little room but to look at these rules. Now, They have a lot of discretion. They can go either way. Everybody looks at this as a deregulatory thing, and I suppose it could go the other way. We actually could get some new regulations. For instance, in the area of cable TV, the courts blew out the cap on cable ownership. I think this commission intends to bring back a new rule and to properly justify that, so that does pass court muster. I know that was a lot of numbers that I threw at you, and the FCC has a lot of numbers on its plate, and I'll just go over them quickly. So as the day goes on, you sort of understand what we're all talking about. There is that 30% cap on cable subscribership, the amount, the number of cable homes that one company can own. FCC's looking at that. There's the 35% cap that I talk about on TV station ownership. The broadcast networks would like to see that raised to at least 50% simply because they could acquire more stations in the top market. Then there's still a ban on owning two stations in small markets. Remember, I said that Kennard allowed the ownership of two stations. Duopolies is what they are called. They allowed duopolies in the largest markets. Now the broadcasters are pushing for two station ownership in the smaller markets. So that's a very big thing. I just came back from the board meeting of the National Association of Broadcasters and in Palm Springs, by the way, which is very warm. But their big issue is this this duopoly thing. They want to have the right to own two stations in more markets. Actually, we're reporting this week that their interest in triopolies, the ownership of three stations. I think for it just occurred to me that for proponents of dual ownership or ownership of three stations in the market, those are sort of unfortunate names, duopolies and triopolies. It sounds like monopolies. Let's see. There's the prohibition against owning broadcast stations and cable systems in the same markets. The court struck down that rule. I don't see the FCC bringing it back. Another big one, and this also always gets a lot of attention from Congress, particularly the Democrats, the prohibition against owning TV stations and major daily newspapers in the same market. Tribune would like to see that go, as would the other publisher broadcasters like Gannett, Hearst, Argyle, Cox, and Scripps. And then there's limits on owning TV and radio stations on the same market, and a lot of people would like to see those lifted. Well, as your presence today bears witness, this, as you've heard from the commissioners, this is a very controversial topic, and they had asked me to sort of summarize the positions, but I think you heard a lot of that from the commissioners, and you're certainly going to hear a lot of it from the panelists today. We have some of the attorneys up here on the broadcast side were complaining that the deck is a little bit stacked on those against ownership deregulation, but I think the both sides are well represented on these panels, so let's get started with them right away. I'm going to go back to my seat and call up the panelists.
Harry Jessel, who is New York editor of Broadcasting and Cable Magazine. This forum live from Columbia University Law School, being brought to you by Pacifica Radio. First panel will have on it Ellen Agris of Fox Entertainment, Charles Lewis, Center for Public Integrity in Washington, Richard Mazur of AFTRA, Equity, and SAG, and James Winston of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. We'll be bringing you this panel, as all the panels today, live and uninterrupted, except to identify the speakers. I'm Larry Bensky, hosting this today from Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California. This first panel will be on media ownership rules, an overview of legal issues, from Columbia University Law School, appropriately enough.
Our first panel is going to start with, how do we order that? Charles Lewis?
Yeah.
Okay, Charles, On the far right is Charles Lewis. He's the founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity. Richard Mazur, former president of SAG and a member of the DGA and WGA. Ellen Agris, senior vice president of Fox Entertainment Group. And Jim Winston, executive director and general counsel of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. We are going to be taking questions, but we're going to do that by index card. There's a woman running, Margot Crespin. Margot, where are you? She's up there in the corner. She's waving a deck of cards. Grab her and give her your questions. She'll bring them up to me, and I'll read them. I have to admonish the panel that you only have 5 minutes. They've given me a swell stopwatch, which I hope I get to keep. But I'm going to cut you off at 5 minutes. I guess you are they allowed to come up to the podium, or do you want them seated here? I guess it's bring. Yeah, they want you to come up here. So I guess we'll start left to right. Mr. Lewis.
Oh, they do.
Charles Lewis is an expert in campaign finance.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here, and congrats and thanks to the commissioners and to Columbia Law School. Just a sentence or two. The Center for Public Integrity does research about government and public service and ethics issues. We don't lobby on legislation. We don't take positions on laws directly. And we are nonpartisan. We alienate both parties equally. We watch the process. And I think that I was asked here because a couple of years ago we investigated the media corporations themselves in a study called Off the Record, What Media Corporations Don't Tell You About Their Legislative Agendas. And the tenor of my remarks are really a cautionary note about the process itself. And I don't know how to put this delicately, so I'll just spit it out. There is a general perception that the Federal Communications Commission and Congress have been a little too close and a little too accommodating to the broadcast industry. And that before we plunge into a precise discussion, which we'll have all day with many, many speakers, I think we've got to just step back here a moment. And I have a very lengthy statement somewhere out there, but I just want to talk about, we noticed, you have the 96 Act, of course. The whole biennial review is from the Telecom Act, which is sometimes viewed as a Christmas tree, a Christmas present to all the various industry folks. They're the ones who wrote in the biennial review and made it principally an economic marketplace determination. If you look at the rules on ownership of radio, you've heard about it. We've gone from 130. Two companies now own. Well, sorry, we've increased the number of stations owned from 130 to 1,400. Just two companies. So you've seen an incredible concentration. We were told that cable rates would go down because of market forces in '96. They've gone up 45%, three times the rate of inflation. There are a lot of things that sort of. There's a bad faith element to what we were told over the last 5 or 10 years that I think bears some scrutiny. But back to the media corporation relationship with the FCC and the Washington, we looked at the subject a few years ago, cover of CJR magazine, actually, which just had a commentary about where are the voices of journalists in all this debate. Not too many actual journalists are talking. Not too many studies, I don't think, about the quality of information improving to the American people and the values and commitment to serious journalism. That's not a topic probably in the act, I imagine. But the media corporations gave $75 million to Congress over a five-year period, as much really as many key special interests. They spent $111 million on lobbying with all the top blue-chip firms to get their way. And one of the moments of flex muscle that we saw was with free airtime for politicians. Clinton, in his State of the Union address, proposed it. Kennard, the next day, said he was starting a rulemaking process. And about 2 weeks later, it was dead in the water because dozens of letters had poured in from Congress who said, if you continue with this silliness, we'll defund your agency. End of story. Welcome to reality. The broadcast industry is extraordinarily powerful because not only do they do all the things special interests do, they control whether or not your mug is on the tube or on the airwaves. That's power. But then there's the Federal Communication Commission. We found that 1,400 trips, all expense-paid trips, were paid for by broadcasters and other media companies for FCC personnel. How can the FCC judge and discuss media ownership if they're taking trips from these guys? Call me crazy, but I have a problem with that. We found that members of Congress, the same ones who voted the Telecom Act, took 315 trips around the world paid for by media companies. Time Warner took House Commerce Chairman Tozan and his wife to Paris for six nights for $19,000. We don't know where they stayed from the records, but I have a feeling it was not Le Holiday Inn. And so there is a perception, I'm sorry, I think it's more than a perception, of incredible closeness of this agency. It goes back decades. It's not just the current administration. And we could talk about political ads and how they revenue increased from 80 or 90 million to a billion over 20 years, one of the biggest revenue sources for the media. And, oh, yeah, by the way, they don't cover campaigns anymore. There's a number of studies. But, you know, there are a lot of things. I could talk about the $11 million they spent to kill free airtime for politicians, two of the networks, CBS and ABC, plus the National Association of Broadcasters. Guess what? It was taken out of McCain's bill. It was rather clear that bill would never pass with that provision. So we have an old story here. I'll wrap up. A regulated industry has a stranglehold over the regulator and its congressional overseers. That's not a new story, unfortunately, in Washington, but it's still noteworthy. So I would just ask three questions today. And they're very simple. Have the FCC commissioners given adequate explanation to the public about why giving billions more dollars to the existing broadcast companies is in the national interest? Has the FCC given adequate consideration to the non-economic impact of those proposed rules on our democracy and on the craft of journalism itself? And finally, is the FCC sufficiently objective and independent to render such judgments given its past history? It is not for me to answer these questions, but to let time and history itself be the ultimate judge. Thank you.
Charles Lewis of the Center for Public Integrity.
Richard, and I, again, try to stick to the 5 minutes. Watch the...
Can you not count my obligatory thanks to the dignitaries here and my... No, I'm kidding. I'm just kidding.
Richard Mazur. Go ahead, Robert.
good afternoon, or morning, rather. My name is Richard Mazur, and Mr. Chairman, Commissioners Cox, Martin, and Alstein, and Congressman Nadler, I want to thank you very much for being here and allowing me to speak before you today. On behalf of the Screen Actors Guild, I appear today, and the Directors Guild of America. The DGA represents 1,200 directors and members of the directorial team who work in feature film, television, commercials, documentaries, and news. Screen Actors Guild represents over 100,000 members nationwide who are the actors, singers, dancers, stunt performers, puppeteers, and voice performers who appear in feature films, television commercials, and most dramatic television production. I am a member of both organizations, as well as the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, which was inadvertently left off the list on my... in the program, and I am a member, and I served for 10 years on the board of directors of Screen Actors Guild for the last four as its president. On behalf of both organizations, I ask that the FCC reject the network's proposal to remove the 35% national broadcast cap. I also ask that the commission adopt a proposal to set a new standard that a minimum of 25% of network's primetime schedule be filled with programming made and owned by independent producers. These recommendations have been previously submitted to the Commission by the Coalition for Program Diversity, of which both SAG and the DGA are members. To begin with, the broadcast market is not a free market. It never has been. The very reason we're sitting here having this conversation with the members of the FCC is that the federal government exerts control over the airways, which rightly belong to the public and must be regulated in order to serve the public's interest. I'm aware of this not only because I have spent the last 30 years of my life working in film and television, but also because I served as a member of the Vice President Gore Advisory Committee on Public Interest Obligations of Digital Broadcasters, which unfortunately did not achieve the desired results from my point of view. So let us dispense with the notion that the best way for the broadcast market to operate is through so-called natural market forces. There are none, and let us examine instead the best choices the FCC can make in deciding whether the network's proposals or ours will best fulfill the Commission's mandate to serve the public interest. The four major U.S. broadcast networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox, have use of both the analog and digital spectra granted them for free and with little or no public service compliance regulations under which they must operate. When I was a child, I remember every January the local stations would exhort us to send letters in because they were asking for comment. That went away, I believe, in 1984, but that went away a long time ago. The FCC no longer solicits in that general over-the-air way those kind of direct comments from the public. And I think based on Commissioner Adelstein's comments before, that might be a very good thing to think about reinstituting. Amazingly, despite this virtually unregulated cost-free use of the public airwaves, the four networks are now seeking additional regulatory relief in the lifting of the 35% cap. A decade ago, 68% of primetime television programming aired by the four networks was produced by independent producers. Today, 10 years after FinCEN ceased to exist due to media consolidation, only 24% of the network's primetime programming is obtained from independent producers. And some would offer that that's because the quality of the independently produced programming has declined. How could that possibly not have any relationship to 10 years of FinCEN being out of commission? So what is wrong with the four networks producing and owning the vast majority of the primetime over-the-air programming? It is precisely what they promised would not occur if FinCEN was allowed to lapse in 1993. They said that they would not favor their own in-house developed and produced product in their programming choices. But, of course, that is exactly what has happened in the past decade, and I submit that this lack of candor, this demonstrated lack of candor, must be remembered in this current review. The networks have not been honest in their statements to this commission about what their intentions are and what the results of their actions will be. The recent FCC study titled Program Diversity in the Program Selection Process on Broadcast Network Television demonstrated that studio executives and independent producers agree that in this new environment, the likelihood is extremely slim that an independent TV production will be chosen to be aired over a network-developed and produced in-house production. Okay, I only have 1 minute left, so which I find amazing, so I'm going to skip to the end. Okay. Program decisions are now no longer being driven by the needs of the public or even the networks, but the needs of the corporate parents of the broadcast networks. Though the network representatives often claim that their interests and those of their corporate sibling cable networks are totally separate, their programming choices give the lie to that statement. One practice is that of double casting, airing programming in a coordinated manner on a broadcast network and a corporate sibling cable network at slightly different times and days, but within the same week. Another is the dumping of hit network shows onto related cable nets for greatly undervalued license fees. Interestingly, as cable advertising revenues have risen, the license fees paid for those shows, which garner those fees, have remained flat for many years. The result of this and other intracorporate tactics has been the dulling of the programming, which makes its way onto the broadcast networks. In conclusion, it is the position, yes, I am concluding, it is the position of both SAG and the DGA that the networks have demonstrated that if left unregulated, they will, one, concentrate more and more power in fewer and fewer hands, two, limit choices for the viewing public, both on their networks and on their corporate siblings' cable nets, three, exclude independent producers from the over-the-air market, thereby decreasing the diversity of opinions and points of view available to the U.S. viewers of over-the-air broadcasting. Members of both SAG and the DGA who make their living in this industry are also being damaged by the decrease in the amount of programming made and the diversity of employment opportunities in such programming and the lack of arm's-length dealing between the networks and their corporate siblings and their impact, that impact on our residual payments. We'll leave the rest unsaid. I'd love to send it to you for your comments later. Thank you very much.
Ellen, there must be another side to this story.
Good morning. My name is Ellen Agress, and I'm the Senior Vice President of Fox Entertainment Group and Fox Television Stations, Inc. In its notice of proposed rulemaking, the Commission correctly formulates the central issue in the rulemaking proceeding as, can it justify retention of the ownership regulations given the dramatic increases in competition evident in today's media marketplace? And the answer to that query is clearly no. The Commission, the notice of rulemaking also correctly recognizes two factors that must guide and shape its deliberation on the central issue: a radically changed media marketplace and a mandate from both Congress and the courts for a change in the way the FCC regulates that marketplace. And I think Chairman Powell aptly described what that is. And I would urge the Commission that it must move away from acting on the basis of anecdotes and emotion and visceral reactions to big must be bad. It must base its decision on real facts about the media marketplace and clear-headed analysis of those facts, and determine through that analysis whether the marketplace provides enough competition to protect and advance its policy goals, namely competition, diversity, and localism. Fox believes that when today's marketplace is empirically examined and rationally analyzed, it will compel the conclusion that no regulation of media ownership is required beyond the proper application of this country's antitrust laws. Together with NBC, Telemundo, and Viacom, Fox filed extensive comments in the FCC's rulemaking that support this call for deregulation with hard data and thorough economic analysis. I obviously don't have time to recap everything we said this morning, but let me make at least a few of the comments on salient points. The overwhelming weight of the evidence demonstrates that today's vast and diverse media marketplace provides more than enough competition to ensure that the Commission's policy goals will be met. To illustrate the point, and only to illustrate it, we examined two markets, a large market and a small market, to see what's happened over the last 40 years. And let me say that is the examination that the Commission needs to do has to look at a local market where a proposed combination is proposed, not at how many stations or programming services or whatever a company may own across the country, because what affects the consumer is what happens in his local market. How many choices does, from different viewpoints, different owners, different outlets, does that consumer have? I won't go through the numbers. They're in our comments. But there has been a multiplying many-fold of the number of broadcast outlets, the number of, obviously, cable and DBS has come on the scene, didn't even exist in 1960. The number of local magazines has increased dramatically. The number of neighborhood and suburban newspapers has increased dramatically in both large and small markets. And even if you adjust for commonly owned media, the average consumer has a tremendous choice amongst these competing sources of viewpoints and information. In addition, the impact of the Internet cannot be overstated. The Internet has created a readily accessible platform for the dissemination of ideas, both popular and unpopular. It allows continually updated information to flow to the consumer, and it allows the consumer to choose the information he or she wishes. And also, the Internet is now available to a majority of the population, either at home or at work, and is freely available to the entire population at schools and libraries. The price of an Internet-ready computer is the same price as a television, and Internet access can be obtained for less than $10 a month. A few of the other points we make in our comments. The Commission has historically linked outlet diversity, diverse number of owners, to viewpoint diversity, but the empirical evidence in the record and sound economic theory fail to support this link. Multiple owners have incentives to diversify both programming and viewpoints and do not speak with a single monolithic voice. Stations that are owned by one of the four networks, and you're going to have a lot of network bashing today, we provide substantially more local news than stations that are not owned by networks, over 30% more. And network-owned stations preempt their network as often as independently owned affiliated stations do and preempt more often for news and local news programming. So there are myths out there about what network-owned stations do and don't do that have to be dispelled by what's actually in the record. I also think the commission can't just look at news and public affairs programming as a measure of diversity. They have to look at what's on in entertainment programming, talk programming, even late-night comics contribute to a public discourse. And finally, the commission really needs to stop ranking media according to how popular it is. All media should be counted equally in determining what's accessible to consumers in their local markets. As my final point, because I've run out of time, I want to depart from my prepared remarks and give you the following hypothetical. If in 1975 someone had come to the when all these rules were on the books and it was seven stations and FinCEN and one station in the market, had come to the commission and said, look, we want to launch a fourth network. And we're going to buy up, you know, there was only three networks. The commission never thought there could be a fourth network. And then we're going to buy stations on which that network is distributed, and we're going to increase the amount of news on those stations by over 50%, 57% to be exact. And on the stations we affiliate with, which are weak UHF stations, we're going to make them into strong competitors in their market, and we're going to insist that they put on local news as well, because we think that's a good thing for our network. And if we are allowed to buy more than one station in a market, we are going to increase the amount of local news on those duopoly stations by 25%. The commission would have said, my God, that would be fabulous. I don't know how you could possibly do that, though. No one's ever going to do that. Well, that is what Fox did. And it was able to do it because the FinCEN rules went away, the national cap was raised, and the duopoly rule was relaxed. So when you look at all of the terrible things in terms of concentration that people are arguing will occur, if rules are relaxed, I want you to also look at the benefits that have occurred. I can't believe we're back to having the same kinds of debates we had in the 1970s about the need for restrictions on ownership, given the huge amount of competition and choices, and rules that really burden only broadcasting, only free over-the-air broadcasting. That's who you are burdening. Thank you very much.
Jim Winston from NABOB.
Good morning. I'm Jim Winston from the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. I'm the executive director. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you to the Knocken Center and to Ms. Ginsburg and Columbia Law School. I want to begin by agreeing with Ellen, which I didn't expect to do today. But I just wanted to say, Ellen, I agree with you. I can't believe we're revisiting the same old issues again and again. A little history. NABOB is a trade association. We represent the interests of African-American owners of radio and television stations across the country. NABOB was founded in 1976. At the time, there were no African-Americans who owned any television stations across the country, and African-Americans only owned 30 radio stations across the country. The association was founded to try to correct this disparity. Today, African Americans own approximately 240 radio stations and 20 television stations. To put that in perspective, there are approximately 1,000 commercial television stations across the country and about 12 or 13,000 commercial radio stations across the country. I think that's important because Chairman Powell was talking about metrics and how do we measure impacts and how do we measure from one biennial review to another. It would be great if we could say, in the last biennial review, 10% of broadcast outlets were owned by minorities, and now they're only 3%. The fact of the matter, there's never been higher than 3% of all minorities. So that when you talk about using metrics to determine what's wrong with the industry, there are no metrics to use because we never owned enough of the industry to have a measurable means of predicting what would happen if we didn't own anything. So if you look at what's going on in the industry today, it's a very fundamental question of how the American public will receive its news and information. That's the principal issue. Yes, entertainment is important too, but the principal issue is news and public affairs. That's what the First Amendment was designed to try to protect, and that's what the Commission, over its many years of fostering minority ownership, was trying to promote. In 1978, when the Commission adopted its minority ownership policy, it recognized that the First Amendment is best served when there are diverse voices that can present news and information, that can present viewpoints. And throughout its history,